Anybody like to respond or ask a question?
Thank you. Well, thank you. Thank you, first of all, for a very inspiring talk. I have a slightly challenging question, I think, in the sense that whilst I can see the congruence ethically between Christianity and Buddhism, and the fact that practices can be shared, so methodologically, there's a lot to learn from the two. But it feels to me that a belief in God is a very different position. And makes a huge difference to how we approach things than not believing in God in the sense of the sacred canopy that David Loy writes about, and a God who can save us, tell us what to do, forgive us, protect us, and ultimately, you know, bring the world to an end. You know, that feels to me fundamentally different, and I just wondered how you saw that.
I hear you. I appreciate the question. It is daunting, but that's why I said this is not a theological position, since I recognize that there are great difference theologically to be stated, to be made. I don't wish to say, you know, we should all call ourselves Baptist Buddhists. I don't mean to be saying that at all. I simply mean to say that in Christianity, I find many ideals which are also usable for helping our fellow sentient beings. I think it's enjoined upon us in that scripture in Corinthians, you know, 2 Corinthians 13. It's enjoined upon us to help each other. That's how we show that we believe in God. If we believe in God, that's how we show it. And so I see parallels. What I'm trying to argue is that I see parallels between King, who was so important in my life. When I first heard certain teachings in Buddhism, I thought, I've heard those before. I've heard those kinds of sentiments before, and I heard them in King. Now, I don't want to say any more than that about the theology of it. You're right. It makes a difference which tradition and how we commit to that tradition. That makes a difference. I just see a strong tradition of service in those, you know, I remember when you could say religion and mean Christianity and have it be a leftist thing. I remember when that was so, you know, when you could say religion and you didn't mean the moral majority or the right. So that's all I mean to say, that I find threads. I find statements, I find ways of thinking in both Martin Luther King's material and in his sermons and in Buddhist materials, and they give me inspiration. Thank you. I didn't show this, but I think I ought to. This is a photo of Martin Luther King Jr. and Thich Nhat Hanh in 1967. At a press conference that was called for King, just before King, after this press conference, he went into Riverside Church and he gave the speech on the against the U.S. involvement in the Vietnam War. So he knew Thich Nhat Hanh. They nominated each other for the Nobel Peace Prize. And in Birmingham, when we children marched with King, King was given a very hard time by the other, you know, organizers, the chiefs in the civil rights movement. He was given a very hard time for putting children in the front lines. He made a conscious decision to do that in Birmingham, the place that he called the most segregated city in the South. And they said, no, it's, you know, you shouldn't do that. And it was in the same year. It was April that children were in the front lines. That's when I got the buses and went downtown. You know, I was one of hundreds. You know, we were so happy to be able to do something. Also because it seemed that America didn't know that it seemed to us that the children, in particular in the South, were being singled out. Before we got to full adulthood, you know, if you were in a car, you had to keep the windows rolled up if you were black, because if you came to a stop sign, white segregationists would throw acid through the window. to blind kids. We knew people this had happened to. The Klan came into that kid's birthday party. You know, there was an all-out assault specifically against black children. So when King decided to put the children in the front, that was a self-conscious decision. We children were so thrilled. Now we could do something. So it was wonderful, but he got a hard time. The second time he really got a hard time from his ministers, those folk that immediately surrounded him, was when he came out against the war. They said, Martin, you're diluting the movement here. You're taking focus away from the civil rights movement, and you're talking about this global thing, this thing that's happening over there. And he was assassinated within a year after this. It was about Vietnam. And so they said he was attacked about taking a stand with Thich Nhat Hanh. And he said, people who don't understand why I would take the stand or why I would stand with the Vietnamese people don't understand me. And I think he was really brave for doing that. He was really, really brave. So very inspiring to me, he was. Mm. Thank you. Yes.
Hello.
Hi.
A few people have said all Buddhism is engaged Buddhism, but in some ways it's a bit of a soft analysis. Mm. In some ways it's a bit sitting for an hour in meditation and having this very qualified masseur massaging our back, when in actual fact, when we're nodding off, we need a tap from a bamboo cane. So another sort of thought that arose from your talk was that there's this talk of there's 10,000 Dharma doors to access the practice. And it seems to me in the West, the door that leads to the rural exclusive practice center country club is so congested it will need a powerful laxative to unblock it. Mm. But the door that leads to standing shoulder to shoulder with the oppressed and the dispossessed is still got dust on it. And so I think we need to think about how we can move more equally amongst, there's roles for both of them. And it's also just on the theme of what our friend said over there about the difference between God and worshipping God and God will save you. In the Buddha's approach, which was, I've given you a manual in which to liberate or empower yourself. Mm-hmm. And it's about this theme about the vows we make to save others. And in some ways, it implies that we sit above them and mm-hmm. we're distributing alms to them. And I suppose, should it not be about empowering people in a movement of liberation? And in some ways, I think your emphasis in the Sarvodaya movement is important. And I think Jake talked about Bhikkhu Bodhi, and although he's established Buddhist Global Relief, and initially its role is to give alms to the most vulnerable, those that are starving, I mean, his aspiration is to turn that into an activist movement on food sovereignty. Mm-hmm. And one of the things we're exploring is outside the US, the biggest group of supporters of Buddhist Global Relief is in Indonesia, and in particularly in mm-hmm. Jakarta. Mm-hmm. Now, Jakarta also is the headquarters of the peasant movement La Via Campesina. And so one of the things is how we can build relationships so that we can stand side by side.
Oh, I'm just happy. I'm happy to hear that. I think that's great. I hope we will act. I think I'm on the board, Buddhist Global Relief, and I met Bhikkhu Bodhi 2 years ago, again at Bernie's, and he after the conference, he wrote me a series of emails. He's saying something like, Jan, I can see you have this urge to act. And I wrote back, no, I'm a bit more modest than that. I just sort of teach. And but Bhikkhu Bodhi is really, oh, let's get out there and act. And let's. And I'm for moving ahead with that. I just think that it's not of any benefit to start blaming others for not being more active. I think it's better to win over folk and then move along together. I think that two things you say really stand out for me. One, I think it's a total misconception to think that pity is compassion. Got nothing to do. One got nothing to do with the other, you know. Giving out alms, you know, going along the route and doing that. That's certainly putting yourself above others. And that's, His Holiness was saying, try the best as best you can not to do that. You know, it completely just destroys any benefit that might come from it. Compassion is suffering with, literally. And it means that, you know, equally, you see yourself equally with others. There's a Native American saying that if you come here saying you intend to help me or help us, then you can leave. But if you've come recognizing that we all have to, you know, move up together, then please take a seat. I love that. And so what I see so strikingly in both King and in the Buddhist scriptures that motivate me is that this is clear recognition. It's common sense. We save others. If we save others, we save ourselves. That's what interdependence means. We'll either rise or fall together. So I'd rather be on the let's rise. Let's all rise together. And I love what you said, and I learn more about Jakarta. I make trips there, so I appreciate it. I think you're absolutely right. Thanks for the comment.
Thanks so much for that, Jen. I really loved it. I wanted to ask a little bit about, after the last talk, there was a question on education. And you teach at a top liberal arts university in the U.S., and I wondered how you take some of your engaged Buddhism practice in the classroom and within the university and beyond as within your role as an educator, how you do these types of things.
How I do them? Well, I'm not sure I can answer that. I've been teaching at Wesleyan for, 35 years. And before that, I taught at UC Santa Cruz. And the students who come to Wesleyan's a very self-selecting college. So these are very sharp students. They usually come from really quite wealthy families. And they come with this liberal to leftist outlook anyway. So whether it's noblesse oblige or not, and I think some of them are standing there, I encourage them to go out into the field. That's how I can, you know, the students are very well educated when they come, but they're very, very theory heavy. So I just send them, I have practicums with all my courses. You have to go out and sample, experience the checkup. Go see what your experience is. You know, some of the teachers say, can you believe people think this? Which I think is, why be in the department then if that's how you begin your classes? But, you know, I want them to get some feel that these religious traditions are meaningful to people. And you get that, I think, being out there, working with them, or at least sitting in a church, even if you might be afraid. You want me to go to a church? I say, yeah. You'd be surprised. And I know that afterwards, they're even going to get fed lunch. Because I'm sending them to the Black Methodist Church. And after that, there's a long sermon. And then they feed them lunch. And they come back so excited. Professor Willis, there was something going on there. I said, you think so? Yeah. You know, we feel. So I give practicums. That's what I do. I build in. I mean, I hope that's sort of an answer. I don't have any looking at myself like that. But I have practicum so people go out in the world.
I wondered what you thought about the role of the heart in all of this.
The role of the heart. One of the things I find, dare I say, attractive, one of the things I find so attractive about Buddhism, and maybe particularly about Tibetan Buddhism, is that there seems to always be a recognition that heart and mind have to function together, have to be used together. Enlightenment is wisdom and compassion together. Bodhicitta is heart and mind, you know? Bodhicitta. Citta is translated heart, and it's also translated mind. So bodhicitta, which in the West we generally translate as compassion, you know? Bodhisattva has bodhicitta. But it means that the bodhisattva, one who is intent upon bodhi, that person, that individual has a mind that's set on bodhi, comprehending wisdom of anatman, and comprehending the wisdom of anatman automatically brings forth compassion. Why? Because the more I say it very practically, and this is why I send out students also. If you go stand on a soup line, two things happen. Oh, you come back really tired, but you're also happy. In a way that you're not happy because you bought that new record. It's another kind of happiness. You know when you've done something that feels good, you helped another person. All right, you also literally chip away at self. You literally give over self. When you're not thinking about self, oh. So they're one side of the, you know, they're just different sides of the same thing. I like the fact that there's a rational part of Buddhism that says, okay, don't let the raging elephant mind filled with negative emotions take over. Take a step back, count to 10. Breathe, now think. Then do a little analysis, do a little checkup. Or you're meditating, and that great part that you read, Jake, the great part that from John Crook, of, you know, we all have these narratives going all the time. But what about when there's this open space, when there's no judgment, when you see the arising of something, you know that it arises, it stays for some time, and then it dissolves. So you can see the emotions, but you can work with them. You can take some distance. You can step back. You can see it. You can note it. You can recognize it. You don't have to get carried away with a narrative. Isn't that freedom? Gee whiz, all we have all the time is I. Regrets about the past, anxiety about the future. Wouldn't it just be nice to be content in the present and say, oh, sounds good to me. We could talk more.
Thank you for your lovely, lovely talk. One of the teachers I've been listening to has been talking about the importance of developing a stronger relationship with nature and art as a way to help to nourish oneself and come closer to an ideal, the Buddha. Sorry, I wasn't expecting to speak and then it just popped out, so I'm not very clear. But I'm very much, you know, of the idea of service being the best way to develop, not only to help others but to help yourself. I was just wondering if you had any views from the limited sense I've made of that importance of developing a connection with art and nature as a part of helping oneself to develop as a Buddhist vis-a-vis helping others. it almost looks like that doesn't really mean anything to you at all, which I can understand. But if it makes any sense, it's certainly something that a teacher I've been listening to has been talking about, this importance of developing a relationship to higher, I don't like to use the word higher, but culture, arts, music, beauty, and nature.
I didn't mean to look that confused.
I'm sure you, okay, that's my own confusion. I think if that makes any sense.
I think it's a great example. One, I think people should do what they do best. Howard Thurman says, you know, you find what you do, and that will probably be exactly what the world was looking for. Oh, so I think, you know, artist, when you really, you know, make something beautiful, I think artists know about taking themselves out of it, then it comes, you know. Taking the self out of it, seeing nature. Then you see it. Then you see it. Not from the point of view of I. You know, I've got this garden and it's mine. But taking the self out of the way, seeing it for the first time, isn't that marvelous? An artist, I think, can communicate that. What a service towards relieving people's suffering, towards making people happy. I think there's much to be contributed by finding our best talents and sharing those. It might be exactly what the world was looking for. So I don't see any contradiction there at all. I think it's a good method. Not some, I'm going to do art because it's a good method to selflessness. I'm just going to do art. It's joyous and makes me happy. And you will make others happy. That's wonderful, seems to me. I don't know if that answered it, but maybe we should talk more.
I'm glad the last two speakers said the two things they did, because in a way they've led into the kind of field that I was trying to worry my way into. I think we want to be so careful about not equating the activity with the whole thing, as it were. In way back in the, at the beginning of the peace movement, to be anti-war and into peace could be an end in itself. When you get involved in this stuff really deeply, if you're deeply into anti-war stuff in a very frontline situation, there's a lot of nasty things you can be involved in, and you need a great deal of discernment. And it's not one program that can be equated with Buddhism. Though Buddhists may identify with a particular program, but it's their love, their heart, and perhaps their empathy for the non-verbal language, shall we say, which can give them discernment and also empower them, and perhaps discernment and empowerment, which is all this religious talk. And if we can only keep it away from the God talk, it's something that Christians and Buddhists can work together, and all religions can work together with. Sorry, was that a question?
Terrific. It seems like a comment. That was lovely. Empathy is a good word, I think. It's not pity, it's just feeling that we're one and the same, not making a distinction. Somebody came up to me and said, after I was talking about the civil rights movement, and said, oh, does that mean I have to try to focus more on now, you know, exchanging myself with others? Do I have to try to imagine myself as a black, you know, had those white water fountains, those colored drinking fountains to go to? And I said, no, I think you just have to sort of know what suffering is. You don't have to become someone else, you know. Empathy, being human, is already enough information to have, sort of, you know, if we really have that, I think, good start.
I think we're done.
Oh, okay. We're in a holding pattern.
Okay. My question is.
Could you hold it slightly closer? my question is about leadership, really, because Martin Luther King was such an inspirational figure, and you talked about when you heard him, your response was, hey, let's go. You know, and hearing you speak, I have a similar kind of response. But actually, in the confusion and busyness and complexity of life, often it's quite hard to kind of galvanize oneself or for things to come together, to really, for motivation to be clear. And how important it seems to me that inspirational leadership is. And I suppose within the Buddhist world, where we can find such leadership, or how we can find a direction to act in the way you've been describing.
I find it amazing that you thank you. I think we start where we are. We start small. We link up with others who are interested in the same kinds of things, and we build community. Don't think that we have to solve all the problems ourselves, one by one, but start small. Do something together with someone else. I think Bhikkhu Bodhi is like, let's get out there and do it. And I think, well, let's do what? Let's first sort of think what we're going to do and do that. I think things grow from actually doing it more than just thinking about it. So I think it's important to start, but you needn't start big. Start where you are, you know? That's what I think some of the workshops are gonna do. Like what are we thinking about doing? And, you know, like, are there other people who are thinking about that too? And let's see what we can do. Things get started that way.
Thank you.